Okay, everybody keep it clean.
Terrific.
It's now being recorded.
It will tell everybody as they get on the line, I believe.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Hey, Vince, did you figure it out?
I don't have a mute button. It used to be push star 7, but that has not worked for me.
Well, just use your hand, I guess, if you're going to cough.
Okay.
I think we're just going to wait another 3 minutes or something like that.
Why don't you hit star 9 again just for practice and see if it turns off the recording, and then you can start another one.
Wow, we'll have lots of things. Okay, good afternoon, good morning, whenever, wherever it is. This is Mark Schenker. We're doing our monthly clinical conference call for Division 50, the Society of Addiction Psychology. And I'm glad that we have people joining us. It's always amazing to me that anyone calls in, but now our distribution list is about 80 or 90 people, which is really pretty encouraging. As much as possible, if you have a mute button, please press it, because otherwise the background noise gets really crazy. But I'm keeping mine open right for the moment, but I'll hit it when I'm done. Today we're lucky we have Bruce Lees presenting, and I went to one of his workshops last year, and he's a terrific presenter. He teaches at the University of Kansas. He's written a number of things that are really important, including cognitive therapy of substance use, isn't it?
Substance abuse
with Aaron Beck, and he's done a lot of presentations. He's the membership director of Division 50. And what else can I say about you, Bruce?
That's more than generous. Thank you.
He's a dog lover, and he likes a good joke every now and then. So, and Bruce, do you want questions as we go along, or do you want to leave questions till the end?
I am happy to get questions as we go along. Thank you.
Okay.
And I direct people to the slides online if they like now. It's
the website.
Okay. You may need to get your fingers ready to type or a pen. Here's the deal. CBT, as in Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, addictions.org, cbtaddictions.org/ like Division 50. cbtaddictions.org/D50 is what you'll be looking for. And then what you do is, after you get to cbtaddictions.org/50, you click next on CBT. It's not what you think. And then you'll be able to click it's actually a PDF of the PowerPoint. So if anyone succeeds at that, please let me know so that I know it works for you.
Okay, and
It worked, yes.
Wonderful, thank you very much.
Okay, I was just going to make two more notes. One is this call is being recorded, so keep it clean. And the other thing is to remind everybody to hit the mute button, because I can already hear typing and phones and stuff like that. So please, let's try to keep the background noise down so we can pay attention.
Everybody's in an echoey place, because I can hear it sounds like a hallway with things clattering a little bit. So I can hear.
That's the one, right?
Very good. That's
better. Yeah, that was great.
Whoever
okay.
Can you repeat that login information?
Absolutely. You're looking for the PowerPoint presentation. It is
correct.
cbtaddictions.org/D50, as in Division 50. Who brings you these conference calls? Actually, cbtaddictions.org. /D50, and then you click on the first title, and then you click on the only line on there, which is how the PowerPoint will come up. All right, I'm ready whenever you guys are.
Go for it.
All righty. Okay, good deal. Hey, It's very good to be here. I am especially I'm especially in debt to Division 50, who makes stuff like this possible. Division 50 is the addictions division of the American Psychological Association. If you're not a member, I hope you become one, because Division 50 does a lot for psychologists and other people in the addictions. So our topic today is one I really enjoy talking about, and the title I gave it is Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. It's not what you think. What I will do is I'll just kind of go through everything quickly so that we have lots of time for discussion. Like Mark said, I do a lot of workshops all over the country, and I can't remember the last time I've done a CBT workshop where somewhere near the middle people said, well, I didn't know this was cognitive behavioral therapy. And I say, that's behavioral therapy. And then at the end, just about everybody agrees that CBT is a little bit different from what they expected. So just if you want to follow the slides, I'm going to read them, obviously. I'm going to try to use them just to keep us organized. Back in the day when I first started studying, I focused on very acute problems like anxiety and depression, and it was very, at the time, somebody's got their mute button unpressed, and I can hear a lot of banging and moving, so there it is. There's a banging sound. If you don't have your phone on mute, please put it on. So back in the 70s, CBT was really focused on very specific problems. If you're following the news about CBT, it is obvious that the studies that initially showed, there's actually a study that showed 100% efficacy. Over time, meta-analyses are showing that CBT isn't as effective as it looked initially. The reason why it looked so effective initially is that if you were the person who ran the clinic, you were also allowed to be the person that that did the research, and you were allowed to be the person who, with all of your allegiances to that model, you were allowed to publish it, and no reviewers asked, you know, who are you, and do you have a bias? So initially it was very specific problems, very acute problems, anxiety and depression, and it was studied, CBT was studied by people who were allied with CBT. So it looked like 100% efficacy when we were treating anxiety and depression, and as we get to more complex problems like marital problems, like personality disorders, severe psychiatric problems, substance abuse or substance use disorders, the research is starting to look more realistic, like our effect sizes are about the same as other well-organized, well-staffed, well-developed models. If you're as old as me, you remember the introduction of, I'm on the next slide, cognitive behavioral therapy in treating depression. I credit Aaron Beck, Dr. Beck, for a lot of this work. I remember well learning about pervasive negative views of self and personal world and others and future. And I remember learning about schemas and automatic thoughts when it first began. And then David Byrne's original book that really popularized cognitive distortions. So the CBT model of depression was, you know, if you think bad thoughts, you will feel bad, essentially. Those of you who are following the slides can go to the next slide. You know, all or nothing thinking and overgeneralizations and minimizing and shoulds and musts and labeling. These are very attractive categories for understanding emotional problems because, to a large extent, they're simple English and they correspond well with moods. If you think I'm either great or I'm nobody, or I got a C in the course, and so I'm really stupid, or it doesn't matter that Mark Shanker invited me to give this talk. You know, Barack Obama hasn't invited me to the White House, so what Mark offered is not, it doesn't really matter. So I could go on and on with cognitive distortions. Back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, they were popular and they were useful. They still are useful. But it seemed like all of cognitive behavioral therapy, and cognitive therapy in particular, it seemed like all of it revolved around knocking people's cognitive distortions out, getting rid of them, dumping them, having them think smarter and wiser and more rationally, especially if you were an REBT guy or woman. If you were interested in cognitive distortions, you'd knock them out and your client, your patient would do fine. So somewhere in the late 80s, early 90s, I started working with Dr. Beck, Aaron Beck, and we were doing actually a study on the treatment of cocaine addicts, people who are addicted to cocaine, and it only seemed reasonable and it only seemed logical that the cognitive model would apply. And if you look at the next slide, those of you who haven't, we came up, this was the original, I'm showing you the absolute original cognitive model of substance abuse, the one that's in the book that I'm revising now, and we were grateful to my very dear friend Alan Marlatt at the time, because he and Ruth Gordon did the groundbreaking work on this. They really were the people that introduced the importance of thinking and essentially deliberate behavior in the process of becoming addicted. So the cognitive model we thought was pretty snazzy, and people said, wow, it's almost like you watch me use. You know that in high-risk situations I get triggered. You know that I have a lot of beliefs about addictions. You know that you know my automatic thoughts without even asking me. So we developed this model that was really common sense and straightforward back in the late 80s, early 90s, and you can see the example of how it applies to this next hypothetical person in the slide presentation. If somebody's nervous or bored, they could think, boy, I need a cigarette right now. I'm going to light up and relax, or I'm going to drink and party if it's a drug or alcohol, and I feel an urge or a craving, and I don't have a problem. I can just do it. And so I'm going to figure out a way to get out of here and smoke a cigarette during my break. So you can see in the slides that the vicious cycle we were hypothesizing was quickly embraced by people we were trying to help. And then we took it a little bit further. In later publications, we really started to think about, and in later work with people with addictions, we started to think about a more developmental perspective. You know, people don't just one day somehow magically get addicted. There are some early life experiences that probably put people at risk, that make them vulnerable, antecedents that are not only proximal, but are distal. So for those of you who pay attention to Howard Schaefer's work or the addiction syndrome, early childhood experiences is what we called it back then, and he has completely beautifully repackaged it, re-examined that whole process, and in a book that's published by the American Psychological Association 3 years ago that I recommend strongly, he started to really look at the research and everything there is on distal and proximal antecedents. Again, the proximal ones are close up and the distal ones are like early childhood experiences. So our model was working, making sense. To me, it still makes sense. But we knew in the next slide, as we looked at people that were not just, I mean, it's pretty hard to find somebody who's just somebody who's purely addicted or has a pure substance use disorder with no other problems. So we figured out pretty quick we needed to start refining cognitive behavioral therapy, what we were doing. We shifted as we realized how important this was. I was the head of the cognitive therapy arm of a multi-million-dollar cocaine addiction study, by the way. And as we went along, we learned some tough lessons. We realized that a bunch of people who were really, really struggling in this world didn't need for us to just start applying these fancy schmancy techniques to our patients. We didn't need to. It wasn't going to work for us to just say, why don't you go home and do a daily thought record every day till I see you next? So let's do an advantages disadvantages analysis. That wasn't adequate. That's the application of techniques without regard for the conceptualization of your patient or client. And it certainly at times looked to me like some of our therapists were doing it even without regard to the alliance. So we shifted again from technique to conceptualization, from the therapist as the teacher to the therapist as an ally and a collaborator. And we shifted from the idea that, hey, therapy is short term. We can fix up in 15 minutes, 15 visits, to, you know, these people have had these problems for many, many years, and they'll have these problems for many, many years to come, and we need to expect to be there for them for quite a long period of time. So those were important refinements. Put another way, the next slide, the lessons we learned, is that we need to increase our attention to the basics of good psychotherapy, and we need to come up with much more sophisticated therapeutic processes. We need to pay much more attention in CBT to the mechanisms of change. People are not changing because we send them home to do a daily thought record. They are, to an extent, changing because they think, you know what, I trust Dr. Shanker, I trust Dr. Leese, understands me and has compassion for me, and I'm going to come back again and I'm going to try what he tells me because he cares about me and because he seems like a good guy and even a smart guy. He was talking about Dr. Shanker there. So then, around the same time, a friend, Vicky Gluhosky, in the next slide, published a paper in the journal Psychotherapy on the misconceptions of CBT, or of cognitive therapy, was the exact title. Vicky working, she was at the Beck Institute at the time. It was called the Center for Cognitive Therapy at the University of Pennsylvania. So she really put her nose to the grindstone and did an absolutely beautiful job of listing the misconceptions of cognitive therapy, and you can find those in that journal, Psychotherapy, but I'll give you the summary. People have the misconception of cognitive behavioral therapies, the misconception that CBT ignores interpersonal relationship factors, that CBT minimizes that therapeutic relationship, that CBT ignores motivational issues, that CBT disregards emotion. Those are misconceptions. A misconception that CBT is superficial, mechanistic. CBT is focused on symptom reduction, ignoring personality reorganization. CBT ignores the importance of early life experiences. I will tell you, as me, Bruce Lee's firsthand, that back in the day when I started doing this stuff, I would have been bored to death if these myths were true. If, in fact, cognitive behavioral therapies ignored interpersonal relationships and factors and motivation and emotion and so forth and so on, if it was superficial and focused on... I was pretty bored, actually, when I tried to just teach people to dump their cognitive distortions. It wasn't at all... there was nothing about it that was very exciting to me as a newbie of a therapist. So here's this stuff that Vicky is doing and I'm doing and we're all doing as a team. And then I happened to take out my well-worn, almost worn-out copy of the absolute classic text, Cognitive Therapy of Depression, the 79 text, and you can see if you have the next slide, it was Tim Beck, Aaron Beck, back in 79 in that book, actually on page 46, 1979, Aaron T. Beck wrote with his colleagues, cognitive behavioral techniques often seem deceptively simple. Consequently, the neophyte therapist may become gimmick-oriented, ignoring the human aspects of the therapist-patient interaction. He or she may relate to the patient as one computer to another rather than as a person to another person. Some younger therapists skilled in applying specific techniques are perceived by patients as mechanical, manipulative, and more interested in the techniques than in the patient. It is important that techniques are applied in a tactful, therapeutic, and human manner by a fallible person, the therapist. This, if my math is right, let's see, this is, we're coming up to what, 40 years ago that Beck said that. Somehow, the psychotherapy industrial complex missed that paragraph when we started teaching and doing CBT. Now, if you go to the next slide, the percent of improvement in psychotherapy, this slide's a classic in and of itself. I don't know how many of you teach psychotherapy, but I was required to read, it was then Garfield and Bergen, for comps, for graduate school to get my PhD back how many years ago was that? Back in the early 80s, I was required to read that. Today, on page 200, the newest Michael Lambert's version of that text has this very graph. This is a rough version because so many studies have been done on common factors, but wherever you look, at introductory texts on common factors, you see the truth in this pie chart that techniques do not account for most of the change that takes place in therapy. Let me repeat that. Techniques are not the reason why people change. When they encounter you for therapy, it is not the cute little techniques you do, the fancy schmancy techniques you do. A lot of it are common factors. Now, not everyone loves the term common factors. Some people prefer terms like mechanisms of change. Depends on who you read. Probably Wampold, W-A-M-P-O-L-D. Bruce Wampold is probably the number one proponent of calling it common factors, writing on common factors. He's done a lot to move the field forward. But what we realize in CBT is you can't ignore the fact, I'll repeat that word, fact, that techniques are not where it's at. And a lot of people took CBT many, many years ago and thought, fine, I can sit down. And there are multi-hundreds of page books on just techniques in cognitive therapy. And it ain't that. That's not where the secret sauce is. As you can see from that pie chart, expectancy or just placebo, wow, I'm going to see a therapist, and I'm sitting in the room talking, that accounts for, this is rough. It varies from study to study. But, boy, I'm feeling better already because I'm getting that placebo of somebody talking to me and listening. Even not that well, but he's sitting there. Extra-therapeutic change. My favorite extra-therapeutic change story, if you want to know what extra-therapeutic change is, that's where you go into your office, you talk to a client, you say to the client, blah, 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 and then you say, blah, 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 and then you say it again, blah, 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 and the client goes, wow, doc, thank you very much. They leave, they come back next week, and they go, I feel so much better. I cannot tell you how wonderful I feel. And you say, wow, I'm delighted. We had such a good session last time. I expected you to feel better. And then the client, patient, they say to you, no, no, no. I was on Match.com, and I met the hottest chick, and I've been dating her since I saw you last, and I just feel terrific. I like $1 million. So that's what extra-therapeutic change is. It's what happens outside that really had nothing to do with you or your treatment or anything like that. So look at the size of that pie, slice of pie. There's a lot that gets better because, and that's often referred to as client factors. There's a lot that goes on because the client has a life besides you, and they have strengths and weaknesses, strengths in particular, that you don't even get to control, and they may be leaning on their strengths between visits that you're not even influencing. We can look at the next slide. Let's go back to the common factors, though, because if the name of this talk is cognitive behavioral therapy, it's not what you think, then what is cognitive behavioral therapy? If it's done right, it's good psychotherapy. I just wrote, I can't remember what I wrote this in, but I just wrote an article where I reflected on, oh, I know what it was. It's a chapter we're submitting to the newest book on cognitive behavioral therapy. In the chapter, I recall an incident with Dr. Beck where he and I were sitting at a restaurant just chatting, and he looks at me, and Dr. Beck says to me, somewhere in the 90s, early 90s, he says, I hope cognitive therapy is gone someday. I said, what? And he said, I hope there's no such thing as cognitive therapy someday. And I said, well, why would you say that? And he said, because it should just be good psychotherapy. All the things we do should just be good psychotherapy. He said, I think I'm on to some things that haven't been described before, but it's only good psychotherapy. So common factors are the ingredients of psychotherapy that are advocated by most models. Mark said to me, Mark Shanker, said to me earlier today when we checked in, he said, it sounds like Rogerian therapy. Well, you know what? Mark, you're right. Everything should sound like Rogerian therapy. And I'm not talking about the cartoon version of Rogerian therapy where we just make fun of, how do you feel about that? And you seem to be sad, and you seem to be this and that. I'm talking about truly client-centered therapy, humanistic therapy, where a human being engages with a therapist who's empathetic and warm and unconditional in regard and caring. That's what Rogers advocated. And he was a tough cookie, too. He wasn't the softy that people make him out to be. He actually was at Columbia University for a while. I didn't get to work with him, but I got my master's there, and he had been there shortly before. So some of my work probably is influenced by his work. Going on to looking at some other common factors in this slideshow, catharsis, you know, just laying it all out there, identifying with the therapist and the mitigation of isolation. I'm not isolated anymore. I have a patient. I said to the patient the other day, a new patient, I said, so tell me this. Are you feeling better? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, tell me what you're doing. And they said, I'm getting out more. And I said, well, tell me about that. And they said, well, I'm coming to see you. And I said, wow, that's more? And they say, yeah, once a week now I leave my house. So they're not isolated, and I needed to know that. That was actually the second visit. So let's go on. Common factors, positive relationship, reassurance, release of tension. I don't know what text any of you have read on CBT or what tapes you've watched, the Gloria tapes or whatever, but I will tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that no therapy is good therapy that ignores these processes. It's not like CBT made some great leaps and there are new techniques and new conceptualizations. Isn't that exciting? It's just more that, I mean, this stuff matters. These mechanisms of change or common factors. Now, you're looking, if you've got my handout, you're looking at the slide that says common factors continued. It's the second common factors continued. Structure, therapeutic alliance, participation, therapist, expertness, warmth, empathy. The next slide, five components of all effective psychotherapies. Every time I write anything, a chapter, an article on the therapy process, you will probably see these five components of all effective therapies. Depending on who you're reading, what article you're reading, what theorist you're reading, you will get variations on what the common factors are. I really find it helpful as a teacher, as a therapist, as a writer, as everything, to have these five components. I think everything can be subsumed under them, maybe not. I've been wrong many times in my life, but for me, everything about therapy fits under this. There's more. Now, every therapy, if you're doing psychoanalysis, this structure. You know, you don't just meet the psychoanalyst, you know, in Central Park and sit on whatever bench is empty and talk for as long as you need to. You go to his or her office. You get there at the right time. You don't lay on the floor, I assume. You sit in a chair or lay on a couch. That's all structure. So structure, collaboration, case conceptualization, socialization, or psychoeducation, and techniques. These are, from my perspective, the five components of all effective therapies. And if you pick up any chapter I've written or even some other things I'll share with you here shortly, I put everything into this structure. Now, to do it right, you have to be flexible. You know, structure that involves taking, you know, the agenda and then getting the mood and then doing the bridge and then reviewing the homework. I mean, sure, that works just fine, but it only works just fine for some people. It's no more true that you can go through a strict structure of cognitive behavioral therapy with somebody and they'll love it. That's no more true than everyone who goes to see a psychodynamic therapist everyone who sees a psychodynamic therapist wants to lay on a couch. The trick to doing, if you want to call it a trick, great therapy, is to make sure that your structure is customized to the people you're dealing with. And that is collaborative, the next of the five things, and it's based on your conceptualization. And eventually, you are teaching people why you do what you do with them. And there are techniques. If you're a psychoanalyst, your technique may be dream interpretation. It might be looking for unconscious processes. It may be just having you turn away from me when you lay on the couch, so that you feel uninhibited. So these five components are true for all therapies. That's the way I like to think of the so-called common factors, because I think they are common to all, like I said. So
Hey, Bruce?
Yes, sir.
Bruce? Hi, it's Mark. I have a question. In reading Jerome Frank, one of the things that he has that you don't have is, I think he calls it an explanatory myth, some way to make sense of the person's issues. Do you see that as in one of your factors, or is that something else?
Yeah, that would be, if you keep it to yourself and you don't tell them, it's the case conceptualization. And if you tell them, then you're starting to socialize them or teach them something. It's psychoeducation.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it.
All righty. Thank you for the question. My intention, by the way, I'm watching the clock closely, is to zip through these, and then we can chat up a whole storm. But I welcome questions like that. So, you know, if we're going to have structure and collaboration and blah, 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 how do we do it? Well, the next slide. You're warm, you're genuine, you're unconditional in your positive regard, you're empathetic, and you have a rock-solid case conceptualization that changes over time because humans change over time. You attend well with good eye contact, body language, vocal qualities, verbal following. You engage in a basic listening sequence. You ask open-ended questions. You encourage responses. You paraphrase. You reflect feelings and thoughts. You summarize. So it's all about guided discovery. It's this inquiry that guides people to discover their own answers to important questions. And then we get to my favorite of the five. I like to say favorite because then people say, well, what about this? What about that? I will argue that it is my favorite to conceptualize people. It is my absolute favorite. Like, my conceptualization of Mark Shanker is that he is a good guy, a sweet guy, a smart guy, a hardworking guy. So when he takes himself off the mute button and he asks me a smart question like he did, my conceptualization of Mark Shanker is that, you know, that was probably a really good question. It certainly was, and it comes from a good guy. We always conceptualize other human beings all the time. It's just that in cognitive, in all therapies, we do it hopefully with some more formality and with a background that we call our theory. Now, slide 24 comes from work I just published in psychotherapy this past year on concept mapping. I really find it valuable in my own head without touching pen to paper or fingers to keystrokes. I really find it helpful to organize my thinking as thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And you know what? I never met a psychoanalyst that didn't like to do that either. They think in terms, you think, I think, as we help people. What do they do? How do they feel? And what are they thinking? And certain problems correspond with certain behaviors, feelings, and thoughts. So when I teach my students this stuff, and again, if you want to check this publication out, it's in the journal Psychotherapy, I think, 2 months ago. It's concept mapping. It leads to concept mapping. So you can peek at Joe's world, next slide, and, you know, Joe smokes, he has marital problems, he's got heavy alcohol use, he's depressed, he's angry. But why? Well, because he has certain thoughts, because he has developed certain vicious cycles. If you look at Joe's concept map, you see that he uses alcohol heavily. He thinks, well, I drink to relax, but then he thinks, I don't have a drinking problem, which really pisses his wife off because she hates his drinking and smoking. And when he has marital problems and he says, I wish my wife would get off my back, he gets angry. And when he gets angry and he's tense and he's irritable and thinks his life sucks, there's a very good chance that he'll use alcohol or smoke a cigarette. So I really like concept mapping. It's a good way to get... the best thing about concept mapping, we just presented this at the Society for Exploration of Psychotherapy Integration, the best thing about concept mapping is that clients or patients love it. When you sit down with them and you make a list of their problems with them, they go, wow, I never thought of it that way. I never organized it that way. Not everyone, of course, but a lot do. And then when you start mapping how they think and feel with them, you can be a psychoanalyst and still do this. Boy, I can tell, Joe, that you have some unconscious thoughts about women. I remember you saying your mother used to beat you, and it's no wonder you feel so inadequate, and you have trouble with your attachments. You have an insecure, avoidant attachment style, Joe, because your mother was mean. So you can always add distal antecedents to these concept maps, which are also known as early life experiences. Hey, we're on slide 26, and we're zipping right through. Let's not forget about the techniques. They do exist. They are useful. They are, from my perspective, I'd say about 10%, 5 to 10% of the time I use structured techniques and cognitive behavioral therapy. Problem, concept mapping is a technique, but it's a case conceptualization technique. So like cognitive behavioral therapies are known for things like what's the evidence, how else can you look at it, if it's true, what are the implications. Just asking good questions is part of technique. If you look at the next couple slides, what do you think about that? What does that mean to you? What goes through your head? How do you understand that? What's triggered when that happens? Moving on to the next slide. If it's true, what does it mean? What are your basic beliefs? How do you explain that? I know from supervising people who have crossed back and forth from different therapies, I know that these questions are very real questions regardless of theoretical orientation. So CBT doesn't own anything. CBT as an industry owns nothing and shares with way more models than you would think. Getting very close to when I'll stop talking. I'm going to fly through the next one, eight, nine, ten slides. Jacques Barber and I developed a scale for measuring the quality and adherence of cognitive behavioral therapists. And that was published back in 1995 in the journal Psychotherapy Research. But some of the items that we devised for this, you know, the agenda, the mood check, if you look at the next few slides, the bridge from previous visits and the status and reviewing homework and assigning homework, capsule summaries, patient summary, focus and structure, those are all structural. But if you start looking at the slide that says collaborative therapeutic relationship, this stuff is important. Helping people understand what you're doing with them, item 10, your warmth and genuineness and congruence and acceptance and attentiveness and empathy and collaboration, all that stuff. So what I've flown through, and I don't need to go through every item, that is the cognitive behavioral, that is our, actually, that is the scale that I think so clearly shows that the other stuff is really important. Hey, I got two slides left, and then I can listen to questions, and we can chat. So the lessons learned in my mind, make cognitive behavioral therapy and cognitive therapy not what people think is that we humans who are trying to care for other humans have to have a full understanding of people's problems and the extra therapeutic resources available for treating. We got to know really what's going on with them inside and out, and inside and out of therapy. We have to understand their compensatory strategies. Why do they do what they do? Why does he keep smoking even out of his tracheotomy? Why does he smoke out of that hole in his neck still, even though he's been so punished by his smoking? Lessons learned, we have to master collaboration and the formation of a close therapeutic alliance. We have to expect ruptures. Jeremy Safran has done all of the most amazing work on ruptures. You know, the inexperienced cognitive therapists feel like it's a rupture when someone doesn't do their homework, right? An inexperienced therapist think it's a rupture because Mark hasn't done his homework. That ruptures our relationship. Well, when Mark always does his homework and nothing stops Mark from doing his homework and every time he comes in it's done completely, perfectly well, you know, it's time for a rupture. It's like, Mark, what's the deal here? Why do you do everything I tell you to do? That's a little odd. So ruptures sneak in all over the place. They can be so minor that they're barely visible. It's somebody doing everything you say, tell them to do. That probably needs to be ruptured a little bit. So the expectation of a therapist should not be to make sure all of the techniques are done and they're done well. Your best opportunities for human growth and for people to learn how to deal with reality is to have ruptures in therapy so that you can look at them and repair them and all that stuff. Always look for competing hypotheses, coexisting disorders, but also it's not just that they have negative thoughts. It may also be, you know, be a little bit creative. It may be that they're experiencing so much transference in their relationship with you that something's going on that may explain what you're looking at today. This is all part of CBT if you do it well. Maintain a developmental perspective. Pay attention to where they come from, like, what was mama like? What was dad like? Not right at the beginning and not for an extended period of time, but I find that in difficult-to-treat patients, it is vital to say, how did you grow up? What did they do to you that makes you so vulnerable to such hurt, such pain, to be treated so badly by yourself and others? Use confrontation effectively. Stay focused. Use techniques appropriately but sparingly. And don't let the pace of change or relapse get to you. So, hey, I'm out of slides. That's what I have to say about what makes CBT not what most people think it is. And if you look at a good manual on cognitive behavioral therapy, just about every manual will address these things. But you can't go in the manual looking for all of the techniques. You got to be looking for the whole package. That said, according to my watch, we have 15 whole minutes for discussion, for questions, for insights, alternative ways of looking at things, etc. I'm intentionally being quiet.
I have a question.
Who am I talking to?
Dr. Lewis, hi. This is Russ Marks at University of South Dakota.
Hello there, Russ.
How are you?
University of South Dakota, I know your people.
Yep, we hung out, I think, in the fall. I just read your content mapping article again the other day and was working it through for a client of mine. And I was wondering, as I was doing it, I kind of felt compelled to, you know, I was thinking about some of the cognitive distortions that have come up quite a bit, and I'm wondering, do you ever include those as mediators between any of these links that you're building when you do a concept map so that somebody could possibly see how, you know, how some of that is, you know, influencing some of the other factors that are going on?
You know, the answer is yes, but very big yes. Big yes. I'm just looking at the Joe one, since we all have that. You know, Russ, one of the best things about being in a scholarly environment is that any idea that you have as a scholar is out there for everyone else to refine. So even if my answer was no, I don't do that, if you did that, it would make what I did better. So, you know, this stuff is out there, including Beck's original work, it's out there to be refined. It's out there to be made better. So, you know what I've done? I'm excited about this. I haven't told anyone this except my students. The problem grid that's right before the concept map, I've created a new column. I don't know why I didn't think of this before, but readiness to change, stages of change. So if they're depressed, angry, heavy alcohol users, cigarette smokers, or have marital problems, you know, where are they in the readiness to change? Because most clients come in ready to change something, but not lots of other things. So that helps in the problem grid. So thanks for giving me an opportunity to answer that, Russ.
No, thank you.
Welcome.
Hi, this is Amy Colley. I have a comment.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. A lot of what you were talking about in terms of, you know, the common factors of being really a good therapist and sort of the, I just kept thinking about psychodynamic treatment, and you remind me a lot of sort of, you know, sort of integrationist kinds of approaches. You know, like Paul Wachtel and Jerry Gold. I don't know if you know them.
Amy, I just finished my term as the Director of Communications and Publications for the Society for the Exploration of Psychotherapy Integration.
Yeah.
I was an officer in that, and I was just the chair of the search committee for the Journal of Psychotherapy Education, where we hired Jennifer Callahan, who's extraordinary. So not only do I embrace and smile from ear to ear in response to what you're saying, but I'm looking at my full shelf full of texts on psychotherapy integration that include most of the people you just named.
Yeah, I studied with Jerry Gold at Long Island University, and he made a big impact on me. And thank
it's
you.
It's incredible,
for your talk.
And I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you.
Hello.
Who's this?
Tom Bryan at the University of Tulsa. Just a quick comment. I winced when you said catharsis, comparing Marsha Linehan saying rather than hydraulics, how about validation balancing with moderation? And it seems like that works better with clients. Sometimes catharsis is like I got to get it all out of my system, and it becomes more like practice effect.
Yeah. My patients, my clients have taught me some really important and sometimes painful lessons. I can't tell you how many, but more than one has said to me, just let me finish. I just want to get this all out. I don't want you to do anything. Just shut up and let me talk.
Yeah, and I just like the idea of that's validating versus keep going. The more you cry, the more you scream, the more you'll get it out of your system, which is kind of misleading. Yep.
Exactly. That's related to the whole concept of narratives. Telling one's own story is a cognitive process.
Actually, Dan McAdams, if you follow his stuff too, in Social Personality, the stories we live by, is at Northwestern. Anyway, he looks at personal narratives and research on themes, and that's a whole social personality thing versus clinical, but yeah.
That's very cool. I wrote his name down. Thank you very much.
Okay, Tom. Sure.
Yes, hello. This is Michael Bruner from the Mayo Clinic Health System in Minnesota.
Michael, I used to teach at the Menninger Institute here until you stole them away. Did you guys end up with them?
I don't know who you're referring to, so I probably can't answer that question.
Okay. Michael, I'm glad you hopped on. What's up?
So, you know, with your emphasis on the common factors, which is something that I certainly resonate to, the idea is that the theoretical orientation maybe is secondary to just good psychotherapy, as you were talking about. So my question is, to what extent do you really need to do a, say, regimented, almost manualized approach to, say, CBT versus, for lack of a better term, a more casual approach to implementing techniques along those lines in order to have effective outcomes?
It depends on almost the purity of the problem. My experience has been that if it's purely panic disorder, the pure protocol works pretty well. If it's panic disorder, if it's panic attacks, I really want to go straight for what works. And oftentimes, what will happen after there, let's say if it's a clearly defined acute problem, not a chronic problem, I just saw somebody with pure PTSD because they got in a car wreck and watched the jaws of life pull dead people, literally, from the next car. Somebody who had no prior psychopathology, no family pathology. This person is responding extremely well to very reliable techniques, and so it's real strict. Now, I don't know if this person eventually will say, I really like working with you. I think I should talk about, and who knows what they'll say I should talk about. I never got over my mother's death, or, I've never admitted that I was sexually abused. So, Michael, it's to some extent dependent on the problem that's presented. The more specific, acute, and the more there's a protocol that works well, the better. Having been a co-author on two major texts on substance abuse, and having seen thousands and supervised thousands of people with addictive behaviors, I can't even think of one person I've ever seen who had a pure addiction and nothing else. Maybe back in the day when 50% of Americans smoked cigarettes, there were a lot of people who were addicted to nicotine and tobacco, and all of the quit smoking techniques work just fine. But these days, with it being less than 20, I think it's less than 20% now, it's definitely less than 25%, the people who are still smoking have some serious problems that they are struggling with. Sadly, some of them have to do with extrinsic, financial problems, social problems. And so with those people, my you know, after I've conceptualized them, my thought is usually, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with them yet. I want to hear more. I want to learn more. But I always think like a cognitive therapist. I almost started this discussion with the statement I start with often, which is, it's not how you act in therapy, it's how you think. No surprise as a cognitive therapist, but if you think like a cognitive therapist, you are. When all is said and done, I really want to know, like my psychodynamic friends, I really want to know what you're thinking. When I run out of everything else, I go, what are you thinking? What is your core belief? What's in your head? What is the schema that just doesn't seem to wash out no matter what we do? And it's interesting because I am passionate about attachment theory. I can cite Bowlby and Ainsworth and everybody following them. And I will tell you that one of the things I love about attachment theory, the whole idea that adults, well, now in adulthood, the whole idea that adults attach more or less securely based on early life experiences, I love that because it helps me understand current thinking. So I think like a cognitive therapist. As I think it was, her name was Amy, as Amy suggested, integrating it all theoretically is a very smart thing to do because, like Dr. Beck said in that restaurant, we're all aiming for the exact same thing, and ultimately we can try all we want to come up with our own brand of therapy, but that's not very helpful. So I hope I'm answering your question by talking about when I pick specific techniques and when I need to just relax and learn more and more and more.
Thank you for your response and for your taking the time to do the presentation today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. We have 4 minutes left, so I'm excited.
That means more. Mark, I'm going to say, why don't we have one more question, and then I've got a couple of little announcements, and then, you know, we can go on with our days. But is there another question?
This is George from Keystone in Pennsylvania.
Hi, George.
I just have a quick question. Unfortunately, my interns weren't able to attend. I would love to share all this with them, and just wanted to make sure that would be okay.
What's going to happen is that Mark is going to hit *9. I'll tell you what. As of this minute, let's say that let's keep our fingers crossed and hope this was all successfully recorded. Mark, why don't you hit *9 now, because it's the end of the presentation.
Isn't it star one to stop the recording?
Just hit *9.
All right, I'll try it.